Morning, we look at the New Jerusalem, segment number 2. Our text is Revelation chapter 21, verses 9 through 27. In eternity, God's headquarters will be the New Jerusalem based on the new earth. John is shown the city by one of the angels who had poured out the bowl judgments. The city is the abiding place of Gentile, Jew, and Christian saints from all dispensations. The holy city, New Jerusalem, has been built by God in heaven and has been brought down to the new earth. The city glows with the glory of God as a crystal clear gem radiates light beams. The city is closely associated with its most prominent body of believers, the church, the bride of Christ. The New Jerusalem is surrounded by a wall which is high and wide compared to the walls around the cities of men. The wall has 12 entrance ways, and each of them bears the name of a tribe of Israel, indicating the Jewish inhabitants there. The gateways are distributed, 3 to each side of a square-shaped New Jerusalem. Under the wall are 12 foundation stones bearing the names of the 12 apostles. And the city has thereby indicated the presence of Christian believers. The foundations are either shaped as piers, as you see here in this diagram, going down, or being placed around the perimeter, or more likely they are in slabs piled one upon another. The New Jerusalem is a literal city made up of real materials, though very costly. Transparent gold, something we don't have any experience with, and gemstones, which we do have some understanding of. The New Jerusalem, with this costly material, indicates the highest quality which characterizes God the Almighty. There is nothing cheap about God, from salvation to rewards for Christian service. We come to Revelation 21, verses 15 through 17. Here we deal with the size of this New Jerusalem. In verse 15, John says, And the one who spoke with me, that is the angel who had spoken to John way back up in verse 9. This word stresses the fact that a statement has been made, and John is aware that it's an important statement. The one who had spoken to John had a gold measuring rod. He had a measuring rod which was made of gold. The angel has this gold, which probably symbolizes absolute righteousness, and therefore it is appropriate material with which to measure such a holy place as the New Jerusalem. This ruler is 10 feet long, which would be the unit of measure common among the Jews. So he proceeds to measure the city of the New Jerusalem. The one who spoke with me previously had a gold measuring rod with which to measure the city and its gates and its wall. The measuring will show the enormous size of the New Jerusalem, and it will also demonstrate its perfect symmetry. We need an angel to measure a structure of the height of the New Jerusalem and of its total extent, and an angel can move about freely to do this. So the angel measures what is to be the dwelling place of the saints with its walls and its gates. Verse 16, the city is laid out as a square. We're told that the base of the New Jerusalem is a square, and thus the length and width are the same distances. City is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as the width. And he measured the city with the rod. And he found that the city measured 12,000 stadios. This is a measurement common in the Old Testament. S-T-A-D-I-O-S. A stadios was a measurement, or a stadion was a measurement of 600 feet. So we do know that to give us some idea of what we're dealing with. The angel finds that he has 12,000 stadia, each one measuring 600 feet. Now what that equals is about 1,500 miles. So we're confronted with an enormous size building, a building which has length, it has width, and it has height. And each of these, we're told, are equal to one another. In each direction, length, width, and height, 12,000 stadia, and they equal 1,500 miles. So the shape of the New Jerusalem is in a cube. However, you can see by these measurements, it is possible to envision the city as a pyramid. It would also be described in the same way. But I think that the cube is more fitting, because the Greeks viewed the square as a perfect shape, and a cube of equal dimensions has squares all around it. Furthermore, God's Holy of Holies in the tabernacle and in the temple was a cube. The Holy of Holies was a perfect cube in its shape, and thus it is fitting for the shape of the holy city to reflect that. The New Jerusalem properly has the same shape as the Holy of Holies. So that's why I think it is better to think of it as a cube rather than a triangle, rather than as a pyramid made up of triangles. The enormous size, to try to give you some perspective, would reach from Mexico to Canada if it were laid out on this present earth. It would move from Maine to Florida. It would cover from the Atlantic Ocean to Colorado. Every street would be 1,500 miles long. That's one-fifth of the diameter of the earth. There will be story upon story here in the New Jerusalem. It will be rising up one floor after another, going on up for 1,500 miles. Now, if these streets were separated 1 mile horizontally and 1 mile vertically, which would be a reasonable distance for such a large structure, there would be approximately 8 million streets, 8 million avenues in the New Jerusalem. If they were separated 1 mile horizontally, 1 mile vertically, it would be about 8 million avenues. And each level of the city would total 2,250,000 square miles. That means that each level would contain about 2 billion ordinary city blocks. And remember, we are talking about some place that in a way we could refer to as real estate. This is going to be a divine housing project, because the people who have been raised from the dead have bodies, and bodies occupy space. Some bodies little space, some bodies a little more space, but they all take up space. And therefore, even in those resurrected bodies, you will be required to have some place where you can occupy a space for your person. So what we are dealing with is God constructing, as Jesus said, "I'm going to heaven to make a place for you to dwell." And what he is putting together are these lots which will be assigned to you in heaven. The size of the New Jerusalem is so so enormous, it just staggers the imagination trying to grasp that. But it does indicate something to us, because the place is going to be filled. And that tells us that there was an enormous number of believers since the time of Adam. And yet, compared to all the people who will have lived during all these centuries, Jesus said that there be few that find the road to the New Jerusalem. So the sadness will be that so many will be left out, while on the other hand, so many will be included. Resurrected, glorified bodies, free of gravitational and electromagnetic forces, enable the saints to travel vertically as well as horizontally in the New Jerusalem at will. There won't be any need for elevators or anything of that sort. All the cities of the world today, you see, are but villages compared to the size of the New Jerusalem. And at this point, it is important to say once more, this is a literal place. The New Jerusalem is not a poetic expression. You would be surprised how many teachers of the Bible pass this off as a poetic expression of heaven, someplace out of reach, not an actual place made of materials like a huge high-rise building, but that's exactly what it is. The New Jerusalem on the New Earth is going to be the greatest high-rise structure ever viewed by the eyes of man. In verse 17, we're given the measurements now of the wall. This wall here, which surrounds the New Jerusalem, and the measurements of the wall, the angel measures the wall, and the word for measure, incidentally, is looks like this. It's the Greek word metro, metreo, metreo, from which we get the English word metric. That word metric comes from the Greek Bible, and here the angel proceeds to metreo, to measure the sides of this structure, and he devotes himself now to the particular area of the wall which surrounds the New Jerusalem. The enclosure of the wall is measured in cubits, and the Greek Bible says there's 144 cubits. A cubit is 18 inches in length. That means it equals, this structure of 144 cubits equals 72 yards, and that converts into 216 feet. Now, it is 216 feet high, or 216 feet in depth, perhaps in both. It doesn't make it clear, doesn't make clear which it is. Now, of course, a wall 216 feet high around a high rise that is 1,500 miles high is not much of a wall, but it is merely a symbol. It simply symbolizes the fact that there is protection for the people of God, they have security, and all evil is kept out. It doesn't have to be greater than that. So we're told that the angel measures the wall, finds it 144 cubits, or 216 feet, and this is according to human measurements, which the angel also uses. John takes the trouble to point out that he is speaking about measurements, and there we have another one of those words from metric. This one is metron, M-E-T-R-O-N. He says, my measurement is in the form of what people measure, and the angel uses the same measurement. So we're not talking about something that we can't understand. It's a human standard of measurement which is used by the angel. And all of this measurement, you see, stresses, again, the literalness of this place. The angel is using human standards of measurement, so we treat the results literally. The size of the wall symbolizing in token the security of the believer and his protection from evil, and the size nevertheless is decorative. And it is impressive to us because the 216 feet are made in relationship to how big people are. So that is quite a wall when it's compared to ourselves. Verses 18 through 21 now proceed to speak to us about the materials, the construction of the wall and of the city. And he begins with a word that gives us calls our attention to the fact that we are actually dealing with building materials. Endomesis. Endomesis. And that means actually materials. Let's put it this way. Actually, it means construction. Construction, and that equals materials out of which the thing is constructed. So he said the construction, the manner in which something is built, is what is in mind here with this word. How something is put together. And the manner in which this wall is built indicates what it's made of. The material of the wall was a gemstone. The gemstone in the Greek is an iaspis. And an iaspis is a jasper. The jasper was a translucent, dark green crystal. A wall of jasper that glows with the splendor of the glory of God that shines through it. The exact identification of ancient gems is somewhat uncertain just from their names. And we try to identify from the descriptions of the gems which we have from ancient writings. We know, for example, that they didn't know anything at all about diamonds. Diamond was not a gem that they were acquainted with at all in the ancient world. And so they use certain names, and it's not entirely clear to us what that compares to in the gem, in the gems that we have today. But we can come pretty close many times because we have descriptions by ancient writers, and we can say, aha, what they are describing, we recognize that. That's this gem with us today. So we have a lot of description, for example, of the jasper, and we have a pretty clear idea of what that is, and it was a dark green translucent stone. In fact, this is one of the stones which was on the breastplate of the high priest. Exodus 28:20 tells us that one of those stones was a gemstone. One of those gemstones was the jasper. When the high priest came before God, he had a breastplate, and it was square. It was a perfect square, and there were 12 gemstones, one for each tribe of Israel. And one of those was the jasper. So there was a connection there already with God. The entire wall surrounding the New Jerusalem is made of a gemstone, this gemstone jasper. Now, I don't know where they're going to dig up this sort of thing from the ground. I suspect that there's going to be some very big creative work of God, obviously. We find jasper in small quantities. But here God is going to make a valuable gemstone in the quantity that can create a wall that's 216 feet high and 216 feet thick, probably, and it surrounds a city that is 1,500 miles on each side, and it's all going to be made out of this valuable stone. Now, this building can be called probably a mansion. I repeat again, what God has designed for you as your heavenly and eternal abiding place is not going to be cheap. People often are cheap, but God never is. The material of the wall was jasper, and the city was gold like clear glass. The city is made itself of a type of gold that we're not acquainted with now. It is a gold which is clear. It is so pure that it has a clear quality as glass. The whole city as transparent as glass, yet it is made of gold. The feature of transparency seems to suggest to us that the city is designed to constantly transmit the glory of the God who indwells it. A little later we shall find that there is no need for any artificial light in this city, because God's glory will be shining and providing all the light that is needed, so there'll be no night there. In contrast to the New Jerusalem, Solomon's temple was only covered with gold. We had this pointed out to us in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 6. 1 Kings, chapter 6. And Solomon's temple in the ancient world was an outstanding example of expense and beauty. 1 Kings 6, beginning at verse 20. And the inner sanctuary was 20 cubits in length, 20 cubits in width, and 20 cubits in height. That is the Holy of Holies. That's where the Ark of the Covenant was to be found, with all the special items that were in there. That's where the two cherubim angels sat on top of that cover of the lid of the Ark, which was the mercy seat. And there, once a year, the high priest came in to bring the offering of a perfect male animal, a male lamb, in order to create symbolically forgiveness for the people of God for one more year. And when the high priest walked in there, he had, of course, been prepared himself by cleansing ceremonially, or he'd have dropped dead. When he walked in, only his eyes saw that room, that perfect cube filled with the enormous glory light, the Shekinah glory of God. And so inside that inner sanctuary, control room, I am hearing a ring. Ring, ring. Okay. In this Holy of Holies, we're told that he overlaid it, Solomon overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid the altar with cedar. So Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold, and he drew chains of gold across the front of the inner sanctuary, and he overlaid it with gold. And he overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished. Also the whole altar, which was by the inner sanctuary, he overlaid with gold. This was an astounding sight, to see this temple that Solomon built, and to see that inside and outside it was covered with a veneer of gold. You can see why the Romans in 70 AD, when they set the city on fire and finally decided to put the Jews out of business once and for all, were delighted to be able to rush in, and the intense heat that was generated from the burning city and the temple itself simply melted down the gold, and they hauled it away by the cartloads. Therefore, centuries later, after their return from the Babylonian, from the Babylonian captivity, the temple that they built was not as magnificent as Solomon's, which the Babylonians had destroyed and had carried the gold away from. So that what the Romans got was really left over. It wasn't as magnificent as the first temple of Solomon. That second temple, which the Romans destroyed, nevertheless itself had an enormous amount of gold upon it. So this whole city of New Jerusalem is actually made of a transparent gold. That is the construction material. And the old, it is infinitely superior to the Old Testament temple area. God's New Jerusalem made of gold is more fitting, a more fitting representation of the kingly majesty of God. And the beauty that is conveyed by a gold city surrounded by a dark green jasper wall reflecting through it the glory of God must be an impressive sight. This is where Berean Christian Academy secures its school colors, green and gold. We are imitating, we are reflecting, we are taking a preview in our colors of the New Jerusalem. And our school colors, green and gold, come from this appearance of the New Jerusalem. Gold city surrounded by this green wall. In verses 19 and 20, he proceeds to discuss the foundation stones. He says, and the foundation stones of the city were adorned. The foundation stones under the wall. We are told that the wall previously was built on 12 of these foundation stones. These stones are unlike usual foundations, which are underground. These are above ground so that they are fully visible. And again, the question is, are they in piers or are they in slabs? I think that unlike this diagram, it is better to view the foundation stones as a series of slabs, one built upon another, because of the beauty is the color of these foundation stones, which again are gemstones. And the beauty is much more visible in the form of a rainbow, color against color, rather than individual piers. So I'm inclined to think that this will probably be in the form of slabs. But the wall is built on 12 foundations. These are above the ground and so are visible. They could be either way, but more harmonious blending of colors if they are slabs. And we are told that these foundation stones are adorned. The Greek word is kosmeo, K-O-S-M-E-O, from which we get the English word cosmetics. To beautify. Cosmetics is an attempt for people to beautify themselves, and this is what God is doing to his wall, which will then beautify the temple upon the holy city of New Jerusalem, upon which the city itself, as well as the wall, is structured. The foundation slabs under the whole perimeter of the wall are made beautiful by God himself. How does he do this? He does this by bringing every kind of precious stone. And here again we have the indication that God is going to use gemstones, which we have in small quantity. When the Jews were under great threat and persecution in Nazi Germany during World War II, one of the ways that they tried to protect themselves was to carry their wealth with them. And the only way they could do that in a way that was secretive was to have that wealth in something that had intrinsic value, and what they did was secure gemstones. And after a while, the Nazis caught on to this and were constantly trying to drill people and to force them to tell where they had hidden the gemstones that they knew they were carrying with them. Well, this is what we are dealing with here. We're dealing with something that has great value, but these little gemstones had lots of value to us today. People who like to prepare for their future sometimes buy gemstones as an investment. But those are dinky little things. Can you think of a gemstone which is 1,500 miles square? How thick? We don't know. Even if it's a small amount in thickness, what a concept that God puts precious gemstones as the foundations of his wall and of the city. And we previously found that each of these foundation stones has the name of an apostle, which again connects the church with the New Jerusalem. So the gemstones, viewing them here from top to bottom, the wall is made of jasper, and then comes the first layer here. And we're told the first foundation stone was jasper. So the wall made of jasper is laid on the first foundation slab, which itself is jasper. This is a translucent rock crystal, and it is dark green in color. The second is sapphire. The sapphire is transparent, and it is almost as hard as a diamond, and it is deep blue in color. The third is chalcedony. Chalcedony is a translucent variety of quartz. It's usually a milky bluish white in color. So here you have a kind of a a very brilliant white stone foundation. The fourth level of the foundation is emerald. This is transparent to light, so it has a brilliant appearance, and it is light green in color. The fifth level is the sardonyx. This is a layered stone of red and white, red sard mineral and red onyx and white onyx mineral. In the ancient world, they used to use this particular gem for making cameos. The sixth level is the sardius. This was a gem which was used for engravings in the ancient world, and it is blood red in color. The seventh is chrysolite. This is a transparent stone, and it is golden or yellowish green in color. The eighth, we're told, is beryl. This is a very hard silicate, and it is transparent. It is sea green or aquamarine in color. The ninth is a topaz, another translucent stone. This one is light yellowish green in color. The tenth was the chrysoprase, which is a translucent stone, apple green in color. The 11th was the jacinth, an opaque stone, bluish purple in color. And finally, the lowest level, the 12th level of the foundation slabs, is the amethyst, which is a clear crystallized quartz, purple violet in color. Now, when you put all these colors one on top of another, as if in the form of a rainbow, you have a magnificent appearance of a city of clear gold surrounded by dark green jasper wall, which sits upon a foundation of 12 layers of precious gems of every color and hue. So the whole New Jerusalem, in addition to its colors, also glows with the glory light of God, and this is beyond description. John saw it, he looks at it, and he records it piece by piece, and you can almost feel him struggling to try to find words to convey the awesome sight that he's looking at. The visual splendor of the New Jerusalem creates an emotion of awe and worship for God our Father. And you will notice that the seven prismatic colors of the rainbow are all present in the foundation. You know, if you take a glass prism and shoot the sunlight to it and then cast it on a white background, the prism will break up the white light into all of its basic elements, the basic prismatic colors, which are violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. And they proceed in that order. So we may learn in heaven that each of these colors represents an attribute of our magnificent God. We're not told in Scripture why each of these colors and these particular gems are used. The colorful foundation of these gems reveal again, certainly, that God is a lover of beauty. This is clearly seen by the way he uses colors on plants and birds in nature. It is not wrong to make your house look beautiful. It is a godly act. It is an imitation of God to make the place that you live as attractively beautiful as you can. That is the kind of a place that God is preparing for all of us. Now, for a moment, it might be interesting to point out something about the numbers. You've noticed 12, 12, 12, 12 popping up. In the Bible, numbers do have some significance. For example, number one speaks of unity, as in the concept of the divine essence of a one God. Number two speaks of a union, as in the union in marriage of a husband and wife. Three speaks of a Trinity, as in the Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Four refers to earthly things, as four points of the compass. Five speaks of divisions into categories, as five wise virgins and five foolish virgins. Six speaks of man, as in 6 days of labor and the Antichrist with three sixes. Seven is the number that we are most acquainted with, the number of perfection, as in 7 days that completes a week, seven millennia of human history, which which completes the plan of God. And man, you see, at 6 is one short of perfection. And then 12 is the one that interests us. 12 keeps popping up in terms of governmental and civic association. Authority in government, authority in civic matters. You have 24 thrones around the altar in heaven of the elders who are in authority there. You have 144,000 Jewish evangelists, multiple of 12, who are in the tribulation with great authority spiritually. You have, of course, 12 gates here in the New Jerusalem, 12 angels, 12 tribes, 12 apostles, 12 foundations, all of these connected with governmental activity. In verse 21, John speaks of the gates. And if your mind has not been blown up to now, it will be now. The 12 gates are 12 pearls. 12 gates are 12 pearls. The word pearl in the Greek Bible is the word margarites, M-A-R-G-A-R-I-T-E-S. Margarites, we get the English name Marguerite from margarites. Anytime you know a marguerite, she's a pearl. Well, we're told here in the Bible that each one of these gates, and it says it in the Greek in such a way as to indicate each one individually, each gate is one huge pearl formed into a door. Each pearly gate opens onto streets of transparent gold. Now, what a sight that must be. You come through a pearly gate and you come onto a street of transparent gold. The pearly gates may, of course, symbolize the church of Jesus Christ, which in Matthew 13, the series of parables related to the present age, Matthew 13, verses 45 and 46, refer to the pearl of great price, which is the church. Matthew 13, 45 and 46, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value or great price, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. This pearl of great price is the church during this present age. As you know, that a pearl comes from the irritation of a grain of sand in an oyster, which causes suffering to that oyster. The oyster, in order to protect itself and remove the suffering, secretes a fluid which covers the grain of sand and keeps secreting this fluid, putting layer upon layer upon layer to cover that irritation point. And the suffering is ended, and the result is a pearl of beauty and of great value. In like manner, we may certainly see that Jesus Christ, through his suffering on the cross, from the irritant of sin of mankind, created an atonement covering for that sin, which brought salvation to the believer, who then became a pearl of great price, the church, the body, the bride of Christ. So perhaps the pearly gates have a reference to that. The streets, we're told furthermore in verse 21, are pure gold, and they are like transparent glass. Pure gold, they are transparent glass. God's redeemed in the New Jerusalem will walk on streets of crystal clear gold. The costly gems and the gold used in the construction of the New Jerusalem indicate the infinite value of citizenship in the New Jerusalem, the citizenship as a child of God. Now, this particular passage of Scripture is referring to these streets of gold in the New Jerusalem, which, of course, is heaven. This verse is where the line comes from the Marine Corps hymn, "If the Army or the Navy ever glance on heaven's shores, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines." And, of course, that is perhaps true. we're not sure about that. But the streets are going to be gold, and they are going to be plenty pure gold. And if there are any Marines there, they're only going to be guarding it. It'll only be as an honor guard. There's a few things then, as we look at this magnificent city, that you should remember. And I stress these because so often these things are denied. First, the New Jerusalem is a literal city. It is not poetry. It is not some mystic concept of heaven. It is a place made of materials. You can put no other sense upon words like gold and pearls and gemstones and all these measurements. It doesn't make any sense unless it's a real place. And if it is symbolic, there isn't anybody in all the world that can give you the meaning of the symbols, because the Bible doesn't explain that to us. As literal as the gemstones, this city is as literal in all of its gems as was the gemstone on the breastplate of the high priest. Abraham was looking for this city. Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, a sophisticated, civilized place of the ancient world, and he left it behind, and he looked for a city, we're told, that was made by God. This is the city. All that the Bible records is meant to be interpreted literally, or it has no message. Abraham went from a literal city, and he looked for another literal city. Old Babylon has to be replaced by a literal city, which is the New Jerusalem, and the New Earth by another literal, and the Old Earth by another literal Earth, the New Earth. Everything is literal that we read here in these final pictures. The reality of God was confirmed to us by the fact that a real God-man came to this earth to be our Savior. Christians are to be raised, furthermore, in literal bodies, the literal bodies in which they lived and in which they died, just as Jesus Christ was. All of this is for real. Second thing about the New Jerusalem is to keep in mind its object and its destiny. Its object is to be the eternal home of the Godhead. It is to be the capital city of the new creation earth. The New Jerusalem is to be filled with the glory of God, and it is to be the place of the people of God forever. Their bodies require room for residence. That room, Jesus has said, he is preparing for us in the New Jerusalem. Yes, you will have a lot. You will be on a street. You will be at one of these levels, whatever it is, and you will have your own place of residence. How you will be related as family groups, I don't know. You will certainly know one another, but the Bible does not give us any information about that. The other thing, third thing, is the relation of the New Jerusalem to the New Earth. The New Jerusalem floats above the earth during the millennium as a satellite. The New Jerusalem is what God has already now created in heaven. During the millennium, the earthly Jerusalem is the world capital. During eternity, the New Jerusalem will be the capital of all the world. On a new earth, there will be no resistance to God as there was during the time of the earthly Jerusalem. The fourth thing to remember is the blessedness of the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem. It is a great joy to be in the New Jerusalem, a place of infinite beauty and of divine glory. The saints there are going to see Jesus Christ, and we will speak with him. God will extend comfort, and he will enable us to have forgetfulness toward all the sorrows of this life. Believers will be like Christ, and therefore they will be fit only to live in a holy place such as the New Jerusalem. The name of Christ will be on our foreheads, and we will not have any, there'll be no question as to whom we belong. And it is probably the place where believers who die now go. Believers who have departed from us are probably an advance party who are already residing in the New Jerusalem. We were reminded in Sunday school this morning of something that has hit the news with quite a shock, and that is that the bubonic plague is hitting India, and the whole governmental structure is on guard and increasingly in panic. Bubonic plague is what wiped out most of the populations of Europe in the Middle Ages, and it was not stopped until the Great Fire in England. It was not stopped until the Great Fire of the city of London. And the reason is that bubonic plague is carried by rats, which are infected with it, and fleas get on rats and they pick up the infection and they inject it when they bite people. And so now the bubonic plague is spreading in India. The problem is that rats in India are gods. They are viewed as sacred animals along with others. This is a teaching of Hinduism. So you cannot, as a good Hindu, kill the rats. The government cannot give an order for people to start killing the rats of India. And they multiply. They have magnificent temples with marble floors. And you can see pictures of these places, and the rats are running all over. And if some housewife finds a rat in her house, she doesn't head for the deacon. Instead, she tries to shoo him out and get him out. But she wouldn't think of killing him. He might be her uncle from a previous life. Probably her father-in-law from a previous life. But you can't kill this little god. And the rats in India now eat enough food to feed the whole country for 3 months. America has sent scads and scads, boatloads, shiploads of food that we send to India, and most of it eaten by the rats, so that the people starve and die. Can you not thank God that you have been called to live in the New Jerusalem instead of New Delhi?